This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
I just wanted to say a little bit about the coming season. I won't say yet what the coming season is going to be about, but we have been working on it. We are in the final stages of putting the schedule together, and I'll just tell you that October 1st will be our first date next year, and we'll open with Seamus Heaney, Nobel Prize winner. Tonight, Jim will do the introduction for Carolyn. Then there will be a change on the stage here, not an intermission, but just a change of the chairs and seating so that they can sit down, and then we'll continue with the conversation. But I want to say one thing about Carolyn. The Blue Hour, her newest book, seems amazingly appropriate for the kind of presence that she has. You'll see in your program there's a note about what the Blue Hour means. This is not a usual program. You can see it was made overnight. Blue Hour is the hour between darkness and day, between the night of the soul and its redemption, an hour associated with pure hovering. Carolyn's poetry and really her person is very much like this in terms of that she seems to be both of the material world and also of the spiritual world. She's someone who hovers between the heart and the spirit, the body and the mind. She reads her poetry almost like an incantation. She's someone who brings a special world with her to poetry and uses poetry as a way to be an activist in the world, to be a witness, and to be a very deep heart who many of us are very indebted to. I'm really happy that she's here tonight, and to introduce her, Jim Longenbach. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here tonight to introduce Carolyn. A woman is standing in a line outside of a prison in Leningrad. Around her stand other women, women who, like her, have brought some morsel for a son or a husband who, after many years of waiting, will wait longer. The woman is a poet, the great Russian poet Anna Akhmatova, and she is recognized. "Can you describe this?" asks another woman, and Akhmatova responds, "I can." Like Akhmatova, like so many of the poets collected in her great anthology Against Forgetting, Carolyn Forché is herself a poet of witness. A poet of witness, what does that word mean? She is a political poet not in the narrow American sense, but in the sense that Yeats or Celan or Milosz is a political poet. That is, hers is not a poetry of chastened denial, a poetry that stakes its power merely on its subject matter, on what it happens merely to say. Hers is a poetry of wild abandon, of the highest flights of metaphor and the deepest swoons of consciousness. What matters in this sense is not so much what she witnesses, but how she registers the act of witnessing in the visceral language of poetry. If Akhmatova looked at the world around her and said, I can describe it, Carolyn surveys a century and more of horror and says not the opposite, not I can't describe it, but she says, yes, I can describe it, I can describe it all too well, and that is the problem. In her second book, we find poems about El Salvador, where she worked as a human rights activist. "Tell them about the razor," she says in one of these poems, "the live wire, dry ice and concrete, gray rats, and above all, who fucked her, how many times, and when." The power of those lines derives from Carolyn's recognition that it's all too easy to invoke those horrors, to wear them as badges of self-congratulation, to feel them as narcissistic rather than historical wounds. It is not your right to feel powerless, she says later in the poem. Better people than you were powerless. Carolyn Forché's poems are powerful because she grants herself the witness, no prestige. Carolyn is consequently one of the most meaningfully honored poets that we have writing today. Her first book, Gathering the Tribes, was selected by Stanley Kunitz for the Yale Younger Poets Prize, and her second, The Country Between Us, won the Lamont Prize from the Academy of American Poets. Following the publication of her third book, The Angel of History, Carolyn was awarded the Hiroshima Foundation for Peace and Culture Award. She has just, in the last month, published Blue Hour, her fourth and most ambitious, most beautiful, and most self-lacerating book of poems. Each of these books is very different from the one preceding it, as it must be. Even poem by poem, as we turn the pages, we feel Carolyn's insatiable capacity for something more, for something else, for something other. The very lines in Blue Hour are high-wire affairs, long, image-freighted lines that threaten to collapse under their own weight, but never do. They register the otherness of the world by seeming to end in a completely different universe from the one in which they started. Here is what seems to me the most crucial line, or to me anyway, the most beautiful line in the whole book. It's three sentences, but it's one long line, and it goes like this. A woman alone rows across the lake. Her life is intact, but what she thought could never be taken has been taken. An iron bridge railing one moment, its shadow the next. This line, like every one of them, is a journey. It's a threshold. It ventures out into the world because it is so deeply embedded in the self, in language, in metaphors that are as evanescent as the world that disappears as we breathe, an iron bridge railing one moment, its shadow the next. This book's masterpiece, of which you'll read only a part tonight, is a poem called On Earth, and it's a poem of over 1,000 lines, a poem in which the lines are arranged alphabetically, as if to threaten us with the possibility that our world is simultaneously random and yet organized in ways that we have yet to fathom. What, after all, could be more well known to us than the alphabet? What could become more viscerally strange, more threateningly uncanny? To read this poem is to inhabit the unknown, to rediscover our stake in the sheer unintelligibility of the world. Did I say that the poem threatens us? Really, this poem threatens Carolyn Forché. It pushes her farther than ever before. It refuses to allow her to take her own astonishing achievement for granted. In this poem, the chimerical poet, the one who says, yes, I can describe that, surrenders her authority, though every one of its lines is utterly distinctive, is no one but hers. The poet speaks for anyone, for everyone, but herself. Carolyn Forché is what most poets only dream of becoming. She is a citizen of the world, and here's why. She carries a passport from the dream-infested, metaphor-haunted, holy city of Byzantium. She has come a long way to find us. Please welcome Carolyn Forché.
Thank you for the beautiful introduction, and thank you all for coming. I feel very honored to be here for Louise. I'm very grateful to John Evans and to the Lannan Foundation. This place, Northern New Mexico, has always been dear to my heart. My first book of poems came from here. And so I'm very pleased to be here, and thank you. I'm going to be reading from Blue Hour, the new book. The Blue Hour poem is perhaps the most personal work I've ever done. I felt like I was going back inside to do this. And so there are several places in the poem, just so you'll have touchstones. The poem is actually, in the present of the poem, we are in the Adirondack Mountains in northern New York State. It's a wilderness area, beautiful wilderness area. But the poem also comes to Paris and goes deeply into my own childhood. It's about my son's childhood and my own. And there's a little mention, and I think you'll know when. My grandmother Anna, who was from the former Czechoslovakia, she must be in every book. She stands behind me as a ghost now in my room while I'm writing with her rolling pin saying, I want to be in the book. So I put her now in every book in a small place, and she's happy with that. Blue Hour for Jean-Christophe. The moon slips from its cerement, and my son, already disappearing into a man, moves toward his bed for the night, wrapped in a towel of lake scent. A viola, night-voiced, calls into its past, but nothing comes. A woman alone rows across a lake. Her life is intact, but what she thought could never be taken has been taken. An iron bridge railing one moment, its shadow the next. It is ni voir que de bleu, it is blind to something. Nevertheless, even the most broken life can be restored to its moments. My son rose toward me against the wind. For 36 years he rose. In 1986 he is born in Paris. Bice the clouds, watch it, indigo, woad. We lived overlooking the cemetery. It was the summer of the Paris bombings. I walked him among the graves for what seemed hours, but were clouds drifting across marble. Believing it possible to have back the field in its flowering, my friend has brought me here, has given me an open window, the preludes, an echo of my son's laughter on the rumpled lake. Go wherever you can, but keep returning to the present. The human soul weighs 26 grams. A cathedral can become a dovecote. I was born in America just after the war. My legs grew deformed, and so they had to be fitted with a special brace. At night, I banged the brace against the wooden crib bars and cried, so they say. The cries had to be stopped before I woke the entire house. In the morning footsteps, a wind caught between roofs. From the quarry of souls, they come into being. Supernal lights, concealed light. Light which has no end. Everything in the world has a spirit released by its sound. The room turns white again and white. For years I have opened my eyes and not known where I was. It was like a kettle wrapped in towels and bubbling, spewing camphor clouds against walls, turning the world beyond the windows white. I couldn't move, and when they lifted the tented sheet covering the crib, it was only to touch my face. This was the year my mother's mother died in the asylum, Eloise, mindless, without protection from the world. Her hair, white, everywhere. Her eyes, the windows of a ruined house. Like a kettle, but made of apothecary glass, so it was possible to watch the liquid boil inside. Sometime later, I would find a suitcase of clippings. Walls smeared with waste, bed sheets wrapped in urine, and how, later, when Eloise burned, they were still tied to their chairs. By late summer, The fields are high with foam flower, fleabane, loosestrife, mullein, and above these wings like chapel windows. The first love is also there, running through the field as if he could escape. They were in their chairs and in their beds, tied to the bed rails. Some had locked themselves in the dispensary as more than fire they feared the world. Here grow bellflower and blind gentian, blue-eyed grass and touch me not. I don't know who came into that room, but spirits also came. Objects in the room grew small, grew large again. The doll laughed like my mother's mother. In every future window, their white gowns. A stone ruin behind a sign forbidding trespass for years to come. They came into the room and left. And later my mother would suffer the same emptiness. In the years just after the war, it was not as certain that a child would live to be grown. Trucks delivered ice and poured coal into bins below the houses. You see, one can live without having survived. I have returned to Paris, a morning flecked with sparrows, the garret casements open over the blue-winged roofs, the two-story windows a speckled fresco of sky. From the loggia, it is possible to gaze out over the graves. In the armoire, books and little paper soldiers fighting the Franco-Prussian War. At the farm table, many afternoons with the windows open, I conjugated the future perfect, ivy shivering on cemetery walls, the infant asleep. How is it possible that I am living here? As if a childhood dream had found an empty theater in which to mount a small production of its hopes. The doors of the coal chutes open. It is the grave of Svoboda, a night paved with news reports, the sky breaking that the world could be otherwise. One does not forget stones versus tanks. When our very existence broadcast an appeal, shall not say adieu when a country ceases to be. A little later, a burial on a hillside in a pine box. The empty flesh like stone beneath my hands. A field lifted into a train window. Under the ice, hay flowers, anslace and lupins. My father digging through snow in a fatigue no sleep could relieve. And the first love, sequestered in an attic room until spring. We row to the middle of the lake, in a guide boat a century old, water pewter in a coming stormlight, a diminishing signature of smoke from one of the cabins. Will his life open to hers, she asks, now that she has traveled all the way to the edge of herself? At night we sleep under blankets, also a century old, beside cold stoves forged at Horseshoe, again 100 years. At late day, the lake stills, and the hills on the far shore round themselves in the water. We climb over rock moss and lichen, through fern stands and up the rain-slicked trail to the peak. No longer could she live alone, as if dead, looking into a mirror with no face. Star-spangle, woodsia, walking leaf, the ghosts of great blue heron. What one of us lives through, each must, so that this, of which we are a part, will know itself. Here, where there was almost nothing, we waited in the birch-lit clouds, holding the uncertain hand of a lost spirit. When my son was an infant, we woke for his early feeding at L'Heure Bleue. Cerulean, Gentian, Hyacinth, Delft, Jouvence, what were also the milk hours. This one, who had come toward me all my life, now gazed at the skies above Montparnasse as if someone were there, gesturing to him from the slate light. He looked at me, and the asylum shimmered, assembled again into brick light and wards of madness. Emptiness left my mother, the first love in field upon field. The dolls were dolls, the curtain a curtain. The one in the grave said, yes, adieu, country, adieu, Franco-Prussian War.
I'm going to thank you. Thank you.
This is a very small poem for my son. He's now 17. It's called Curfew. There are two little things that it might be nice for you to know. I took him to Paris several times during his childhood. And once, when he was 7, I thought it would be interesting for him to walk through the catacombs below the 14th arrondissement, which are it's 6 kilometers of ancient human bones stacked in various arrangements along the wall, because the Paris cemeteries had filled up and they had to be emptied again to make room for more of the dead. The workmen who had this job of stacking the bones in the tunnels, you know, maybe they were bored or something, and they made little heart shapes and various designs with the bones. And we walked for 6 kilometers, and he was fascinated, but he didn't say a word the entire time. And then I took him a few days later to the Memorial of the Deportees, which is a memorial on the banks of the Seine, just behind Notre Dame Cathedral. You'll see a little white staircase behind the cathedral. That's where it is. There's a long tunnel with 200,000 tiny beads of light embedded in it, one for each of those deported from France to the camps during the Holocaust. And there's a single light at the end of the tunnel and a slab at the beginning on which is carved, Ici repose un déporté inconnu. Here lies the unknown deported one. Here is Sean's poem. The curfew was as long as anyone could remember. Certainty's tent was pulled from its little stakes. It was better not to speak any language. There was a man cloaked in doves. There was chandelier music. The city, translucent, shattered, but did not disappear. Between the no longer and the still to come, the child asked if the bones in the wall belonged to the lights in the tunnel. Yes, I said, and the stars nailed shut his heaven. Refuge. In the blue silo of dawn, in earth smoke and birch cups, where the river of hands meets the Elbe, in the peace of your sleeping face, mein Liebchen. We have our veiled memory of running from police dogs through a blossoming orchard, and another of not escaping them. That was ago, a lifetime. But now you are invisible in my arms. A soul acquiring speech. The body, its blind light, whispering noli mi frangere, even as it is in death shattered. We were one in the other. When the doves rose at once and our refuge became wing light. This poem is called Writing Kept Hidden. My husband and I were in Beirut, Lebanon, during the war of 1983-84. This poem arises out of that. It was the time of the Marine Barracks bombing and the firing of the USS New Jersey on the Shoof Mountains. The black fire of ink on paper took hold of their souls. Incorporeal fire. There was no protection this fire couldn't touch, nor darkness, nor a moment. It lasted as long as a dream. It was no dream. Heteroglossia of nervous shortwave, cloud of blown walls. In the barracks, those who had sketched themselves in coal and smoke became coal and smoke, and the living remained, linking unknown things to the known. Residue, scapular, matchlight, name on a tongue. Then, for an hour, the war slept, and rain filled the cisterns with silence. Our windows faced east, and on August evenings the sky was a blue no longer spoken. I will tell you a funny story about Beirut, because I don't want you to leave too depressed today. My husband was working with Time magazine, and I was working with NPR. And there was an occasion when, for a week, the area of Beirut we were living in was under shell fire. So the press corps took refuge in an abandoned nightclub, which was in the basement of a hotel. And this nightclub was painted with Scheherazade naked ladies, and it had a piano that was overturned. It had lots of crates all over the place that were kind of locked up. So I asked, we were all down there one night, and it was over us. So I asked the hotel manager, who seemed to know everyone and could do everything, what the crates were for, what was in them. And he said, well, there's three things. Those over there, those are gold bullion. And those over there, those are Kalashnikov rifles. And those over there, those are filled with nice French cognac, very fine. He said, the gold bullion is what we pay so that this hotel doesn't get bombed. The Kalashnikovs are if the gold bullion doesn't work. The French cognac is if the Kalashnikovs don't work. So that night, that water went off, and the journalists decided to pry open the crates with the cognac. And they drank it out of the water glasses. So everyone fell asleep. I didn't fall asleep because I can't sleep through this, you know, leveling of the world. So I took my little shortwave and I'm dialing and dialing to try to find some news report. I want to know what's happening. Finally, a man from England, worked, I think, with the BBC, said, my dear, what are you doing? And I said, I'm looking for the news. And he sat right up and he said, madam, we are the news. And he crashed back down on the floor. So this is so that you won't take the press too seriously, especially now. In the exclusion zones, ash over conifers and birches, over berry thickets, resembling snow, and its synonyms, silvered fields of millet, a silence approaching bees of the invisible or scent of mint. One need not go further than a white towel hung in an open door. Hive. This is a poem about bees, ostensibly. Into a light most unexpected, the glass hives, executed labors whose writings in a darkness are lost. Meanwhile, they exhaust the city's supplies and live only in the midst, however abundant. Inaudible to them, the murmur that comes to us, song of abundance, psalms of grief, an entire absence of hesitation whereby they break with the past, as though with an enemy. It is not without prescience their summoning, as though nothing is happening will come back to live as long as the world itself in those who come after. Too vast to be seen, too alien to be understood, prefers what is not yet visible to that which is. As a society organizes itself and rises, so does a shrinkage enter. So crowded does the too prosperous city become. The era of revolutions may close and work become the barricade, suddenly abandoning generations to come. The abode of the future wrapped in a shroud. A door standing not now where once it stood. We are so made that nothing contents us. Prayer. Begin again among the poorest, moments off in another time and place. Belongings gathered in the last hour, visible, invisible. Tin spoon, teacup, tremble of tray, carpet hanging from sorrow's balcony. Say goodbye to everything. With a wave of your hand, gesture to all you have known. Begin with bread torn from bread, beans given to the hungriest, a carcass of flies. Take the polished stillness from a locked church. Prayer notes left between stones. Answer them. And hoist in your net voices from the troubled hours. Sleep only when the least among them sleeps, and then only until the birds. Make the flatbed truck your time and place. Make the least daily wage your value. Language will rise then, like language from the mouth of a still river. No one's mouth. Bring night to your imaginings. Bring the darkest passage of your holy book. I'd like to read a little bit of On Earth now. It is a very long poem, so I'm going to read you only little bits. It is in alphabetical order all the way in the lines. It's a journey of mind through the passage from life to death. A mind, a single mind, a collective mind. As I on the day I finished it, a book leapt off my shelf by itself and fell flat open. It was a book I was planning to assassinate myself because it was an old book I'd bought in a farmer's market and I was going to make sort of book art out of it. I was going to cut it up. And so this was an attempt, I think, on its part to save itself. Because when I opened it, I read this passage and it became the epigraph of On Earth that was just completed. The recollections of a whole life. The consciousness of spiritual existence and all which is mightiest and deepest in our nature become brighter, even in opposition to extreme bodily languor. In the immediate vicinity of death, the mind enters on an unaccustomed order of sensations, a region untrodden before from which very few travelers have returned, and from which those few have brought back but vague remembrances, sometimes accompanied with a kind of homesickness for the higher sphere of which they had then some transient prospect. Here, amidst images, dim images of solemnity or peace, of glory or of terror, the pilgrim pursues his course alone and is lost to our eye. George Burgess, 1850. It's a litany of sorts, a prayer. A barn loft of horse dreams with basin and bedclothes, a bit of polished quiet from a locked church, a black coat in smoke, a black map of clouds on a lake. A blackened book leaf, straw and implements, a blue day book hidden in my bed with his name. A branch weighted with pears, a brittle crack of dawnlight. A broken clock, a boy awakened by his father's whip, then the world as if whirled into place. A broken equation, a partita, a bullet clicking through her hair. a bullet-holed supper plate, a burnt room strewn with toy tanks, a century passing through it, a chaos of microphones, a city 1,000 years, a city shaken and snowing. A corpse broken into many countries, a cup of sleep, a desire to live as long as the world itself. A memory through which one hasn't lived, a message deflected by other messages, a message from a secret self. A random life caught in a net of purpose. A record keeper of human and earthly life. A rifle loaded with moments. A rivulet of sweat on the brow of the one keeping watch. A road erased by light, a road that ends nothing. A salvage yard of burnt office furniture and household goods. A scarf of smoke from a mouth. A schooner sailing in a bottle of light. A search without hope for hope. A secret that stands apart from every secret. A web of survivals, a wind of burnt documents borne by wind. A white rain, then your face becoming another's. A white road billowing behind the relief trucks, a white road ending in one's own life. Air filled with ash, notebooks with sorrowing ink, airfield to airfield algebraic music. A laze of tall trees, alluvial plains, alpha rays of plutonium. Although we are a small group on a private tour, America, a warship on the horizon at morning. And collective memory, a dread of things to come. And in the dream, ce voyage, je voulais le refaire. And in the villages, laundry hanging for months. And in their eyes, the years taken from them. And it is certain someone will be at that very moment pouring milk. And it is supposed that we are describing the world and its corresponding moment in the past. And night, a knock at the window, and night, a storehouse. As though when past and present converge, there is a gap. As thought affects the universe in as yet immeasurable ways. As unexpected rain craters the fields, as when cicadas sing at the cenotaph. Before and behind us, behind the face that speaks to us and to whom we speak, beings who have chosen one another. Cordite wind, one's first cordite. Corn black in the fields, crib smoke, bones, a rib cage. Corrugated fields. Sheep on the bare fields of drought. Cotton mats spread on the floors of the classrooms. Countries erased from their maps. Death is not the conclusion of earthly life. Death is the descent of the one called. Fresh wind in the linens, from a gloved hand, a flaming bottle, from chance to chance, event to event, from earth to satellite, event to event. God, not a being, but a force, and humans the probative tip of that becoming. God withdrawn from the world. History decaying into images. I am alone, so there are four of us. I am here blowing into my hands. You are in the other coffin. In the cellar, three crates. Rifles, gold, and cognac. In the cesium fields. In the chaotic light, in the coal-smoked heavens. In the cities of what can be said. In the country of our advanced years. In the ecstasy of standing outside oneself. in the mathematical language of a time to come. Is there anything else? It appears to be an elegy put into the mouth of a corpse. It is as though space were touching itself through us. It is more ominous than any oblivion to see the world as it is. Misprision of moments lifted from their concealment, moments of rain ascend in the manner of smoke. More ominous than any oblivion. Mortar smoke mistaken for an orchard of flowering pears. Neither a soul nor a body, neither for us nor near itself. No breath of God, no words, and no possibility of restoration. No content may be secured from them. No one prayer resembling another. Not a house, but a stagnant hour. Not blood, flesh, and bread, but an earthly ecstasy. Not isolation, but a lack of solitude. Not only the flow of thoughts, but their arrest. Not wishing to know anything more about oneself. On the short wave, the high whine of the world's signal, our hymnic song against death. Redemption, not an accounting or a debt. Remaining in fear of death, but remaining. Resting language, or language under surveillance, reverses itself as we read it. Searching for something one knows will not be found, set in language and deserted by God. That even this refuge might be taken. That ing, ing of verbs in an eternal present. That light traveled from the eye to the world. That nothingness might not be there. That you might become one among others. The dreams are a coffin with an open window, the dreams of a mind in the grave. The eyes, time in which things happen, the ice of reminiscence submerged in time. The soul weighs 26 grams and is migratory like the birds. The soul, enamored of greatness, the soul with its sense of destination, the soul exiled, a stranger to earth. The tomb into which we escape. To abandon yearning for the body, to be unquiet, to be visible to oneself, to become endlessly what one has been, to cross the field without breaking the snow, to enter into itself and to stay awake, to expose ourselves to whatever may happen, to forget once having known it, to hide, safeguard, and trust to a protected place, to know not only what is, but the other of what is, to know that the great bell is the great bell, to remain haunted, to rescue the future, to say nothing without confining ourselves to silence, to search like a sheep for salt, to see or to perish, to see other than from without, to see the world as it actually is. There's a little coda after this poem ends. I didn't read to Z after death. From the quarry of souls, they come into being. Supernal lights, concealed light, light which has no end. That which thought cannot attain, the going forth, the as yet cannot be heard. As a flame is linked to its burning coal, to know not only what is, but the other of what is. To end, I would like to read a poem by Mahmoud Darwish. It was a new translation. Unfortunately, it was Paradise. And Mahmoud Darwish received the Cultural Freedom Award from the Lannan Foundation a year ago. And he came to the United States and gave a reading sponsored by the Lannan Foundation. It was very beautiful. I'd like to read a poem called Lesson from the Kama Sutra. Wait for her with an azure cup. Wait for her in the evening at the spring among perfumed roses. Wait for her with the patience of a horse trained for the mountains. Wait for her with the distinctive aesthetic taste of a prince. Wait for her with seven pillows of cloud. Wait for her with strands of womanly incense wafting. Wait for her with the manly scent of sandalwood on horseback. Wait for her, and do not rush. If she arrives late, wait for her. If she arrives early, wait for her. Do not frighten the birds in her braided hair. Wait for her to sit in a garden at the peak of its flowering. Wait for her so that she may breathe this air so strange to her heart. Wait for her to lift her garment from her leg, cloud by cloud. And wait for her. Take her to the balcony to watch the moon drowning in milk. Wait for her and offer her water before wine. Do not glance at the twin partridges sleeping on her chest. Wait and gently touch her hand as she sets a cup on marble. As if you are carrying the dew for her, wait. Speak to her as a flute would to a violin string, as if you knew what tomorrow would bring. Wait and polish the night for her, ring by ring. Wait for her until night speaks to you thus. There is no one alive but the two of you. So take her gently to the death you so desire, and wait. Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, Carolyn, you read beautifully. Thank you
very much.
There's a thousand things we need to talk about. and I want to touch on a couple of the poems that you read tonight, and then we'll maybe look back at a few things and then out at the world. I think the last time we saw each other, we were prancing around someone's living room singing West Side Story,
yes,
weren't we? So we'll try to be a little bit more staid tonight if we can manage it.
We discovered this wonderful fondness for the lyrics of Broadway musicals and that we knew them all.
So, all of them.
All of them.
That aside, I very badly want to know how On Earth came to be. You don't wake up one morning and think, I'm going to write a 1,000-line poem with all the lines in alphabetical order. How did it, what made it happen? What was the process by which you came to arrive at this astonishing inevitability for this poem? It could be no other way.
I had no premonition. And if anyone had told me a year earlier that I would write a 1,000-line poem in alphabetical order, I probably would have worried about myself and certainly would have doubted them. But I'm not sure. We don't really know how things happen, of course, when we're writing. Mm-hmm. I have a few little guesses. I've always been in love with images and have always, I loved to describe when I was little, to describe things. I wrote paragraphs for the Dominican nuns, you know, that were descriptions of things. And I would even pretend to know what was going on under the soil and how the stems looked and how the little roots looked. And I would fancifully describe all of this. And so I grew up with this sort of proclivity for visual image. And I collect them all the time. So if I see one in the world or one comes to me, I write them. I write them on little shopping bags and bits of paper. And so I have many, many of these. They're like a mosaic of images of world. They're details of world. And I had them all. I had many thousands of them. And I didn't know quite what to do, you know, but I knew that they were the remnants of world for a certain kind of consciousness that had passed through events, but I wanted to somehow inhabit the region of soul that was incapable of articulating them in a narrative that would be very explanatory. Mm. So I started to list them, and I played with different kinds of lists and incantations. And finally, the alphabetization began to happen, and I just went with that. Mm-hmm. And it was much longer. It grew and grew, and there was a place where all of the mosaic chips, you know, and all of the little scraps of language and the images, and then I realized that this was a kind of bardo, and that it might not be only one person, and that it was moving from a singularity to a collectivity. And it got longer and longer, and then it was time to revise it. It's very difficult to revise a poem that's in alphabetical order. you can't move things around. You can only take them out. And then it's like building a little house with matchsticks. You take one out and the whole thing falls apart. So it took the real work of the poem was the structural work, the sort of, you know, work of keeping it mortared and keeping it working and keeping it holding up while I was taking things out, and I took out half of it. Huh. Then, about halfway through this revision, I had been looking at ancient texts, Nag Hammadi, Dead Sea Scrolls, apocryphal scriptures. And one of the things about the Nag Hammadi that discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls is that a lot of the text is missing, or there are bits and pieces, and you're reading for the gaps and for what is, you know, guessed at in the translations as much as for what's available in the text. So this led me to discover another group of hymns that were, they were also found in the deserts of Central Asia in the 20th century, and they were Parthian Gnostic hymns from the Central Asian deserts, and they were not the traditional abecedary poems in English where you have 26 lines, A through Z. They were poems that had a multitude of A's and B's and C's, and they went on and on and on, but they were in the same form that I was working in. I was very shocked to find them because they were written in the 4th century. It's a scary moment, a beautiful moment. Wonderful, for a poet. Yeah. To find a form that's a precursor to something that goes back 17 centuries. So I thought, well, this is something then. You know, it's okay to write this. It's been done before. You know, I can argue that it's a form, and that I'm now a formal poet, and I've done this. So I decided that it was acceptable to keep going. And then I began to feel that it was... It has a strange effect upon me, this poem. I've only read it a few times in its entirety. You know, where you get all the way to the end and the person dies. So it's strange. It's strange for me, too.
Well, it's, you know, you selected from it beautifully, but I think no selection could possibly render the necessary experience of inhabiting the whole thing. Which is, you know, and partly you are beautifully exhausted by it because you so inhabit the process of this astonishing temporality of glimpse, gone, visible, invisible, to use a phrase that recurs mm-hmm. throughout the Blue Hour. And you have to have the excess of it to feel that fully, I think. So we must go all read it.
It became really wonderful in the sense that it raised questions to the surface of my consciousness that, you know, that I must have been thinking about without realizing it. Hmm. You know, questions having to do with human consciousness, temporality, the difficulties surrounding remembering and forgetting, how events fuse with one another in the course of a lifetime, how we begin to have a feeling that we're seeing patterns in things, whether that is our own capacity of mind to structure according to pattern or whether the patterns are available,
yes,
then becomes a moot question. And then, of course, you know, the deity kept coming in, and the nature of the soul, the nature of the human soul.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fascinating to me to get those lines,
mm-hmm,
because they were gifts. They would come and I'd read them and think, oh my gosh, where is that? Mm-hmm. What is that?
Mm-hmm. And then they go.
And then they go and they disappear and they don't explain themselves.
Right. That not explaining seems crucial to me, and the temporality of it seems crucial to me. It's crucial to the whole book. It seems to be the real keynote of it. You get Blue Hour is the first poem in the book, and On Earth is the last. And you know, near the beginning of Blue Hour, you get that line that I love so much, ending with the
iron, bridge railing.
Bridge railing, the iron bridge railing there, and then not there. And that, you know, neither you nor I are old enough to know anything about middle age, but it does...
Thank you.
But it does seem to me that it's something that this book, unlike the earlier books, seems to be, to come from a place in you that is on the other side of something. And the way in which that opening poem finds a rhetoric for intimacy is a new note for you. And it goes, and it seems tied to this acute sense of the temporal and things passing. Is that something you're aware of, or?
Oh. I don't think I was aware of it before I wrote this.
Uh-huh.
I think
that's what you discovered.
I think writing has always been for me my way of coming to awareness. I have to write on the page in order to know what I'm thinking. You know, it's the same way that I have to write a word down to know how to spell it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't. If someone asks me, how do you spell such and such, I write it and then I know. And I think that for me, my questions are answered on the page too. And I did feel a kind of breaking through to an intimate language with this. It was difficult to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had a little bit of the inside story here because, as you remember, I saw drafts of that poem.
Mm-hmm.
Over several years, and what was fascinating about watching, I'm speaking of Blue Hour now, particularly, though there were others, what was fascinating about watching that poem discover itself over that period was the way in which the more worldly references kept getting deleted, kept falling out of it, as if there was this part of you that knew how to do that, had done that, and couldn't do that so much anymore in order to push yourself to find some other kind of interior space for the poem.
I think, you know, I just realized something with you saying this. I think it's harder for me to write from within my feelings about being a mother and growing older and assembling a kind of sense of my life. It's harder for me to do that than it is for me to write about events that I've seen in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, poets always want to do, I think we want to do the scary thing. I mean, that's what we would like to want, anyway.
Of course.
So, and I learned that from Louise Glück. Louise Glück wants to do the most frightening thing on the page. The most frightening thing for her. It wouldn't necessarily be for someone else. But I think that kind of personal disclosure was difficult because I was used to writing about the world outside, and especially mm-hmm. In my earlier work in a documentary way, what mm-hmm. I had seen, what I felt needed to be said, and this is a turn. It's not a definitive turn.
No.
It's not over, but that's, I think...
It's a different music. It's a different, you know, it's not... You know, as I think as I was trying to say in when I was talking about you earlier, it's not so much a question of what you're writing about, it's a question of inhabiting the language of the poem in fresh ways, and that leads to a more acute and mysterious kind of lyricism that propels the poem forward. How do you feel looking back on earlier work, on The Country Between Us? What do you... You were so young then.
I was very young. I was very... I was very young, and I feel... I don't feel... I feel an affection for the early work.
Mm-hmm.
The Gathering of Tribes, it comes right out of these mountains and deserts and out of my grandmother, my Czechoslovakian grandmother's influence and on my upbringing and my first discovery of wilderness. And with The Country Between Us, it continued. I was continuing to grow as a poet, and I was writing first-person lyric narrative poems, but they were arising out of experiences in El Salvador. And the difficult part of that book for me was the reception of it. You know, I became a controversial poet overnight, and and people talked about it as a political book of poems. And I was a little bit surprised by that, although that'll sound naive to all of you, and it is. But I didn't realize that they would be regarded that way. Mm. I thought they were...
Well, you couldn't have been thinking that. You were,
no. Yeah. But then they opened a beautiful door for me. What happened as a result of that book was that I was able... I wasn't a journalist. I was never a journalist, and I wasn't trained as a journalist. And when I got back from El Salvador, I really wanted to do something more. And that book gave me a chance to talk to audiences and to read poetry to audiences concerned about stopping intervention in Central America. And people came to hear the poetry, and then we had discussions about military and aid and economic aid to Central America and so on. And so it gave me an opportunity to speak on behalf of something that was dear to me and important to me. And so I honor that book because of it. And, you know, we can always revise. We always think of ways we could have made the poems better. But once they're published, they're sort of carved in stone. So that's over. And it's been a nice journey because after that, The Country Between Us, there was another decade. And in that decade, I wanted to develop a response to the controversy about The Country Between Us. That controversy seemed reductive to me. It seemed that on the one hand, people were praising poetry that was about political things because it was about important things, not necessarily because it was good poetry or anything. And on the other hand, condemning poets because they wrote about political things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's no place in the lyric poem. And so I thought this is reductive and not interesting. And I began to read, comparatively, works in translation from poets who had endured conditions of extremity in the 20th century, and this led to the Assembly of Against Forgetting, which is the anthology you referred to. And this is meant, it was meant to open a space, not for a way to write, but for a way to read, to complicate our reading and deepen our reading of poets whose language has been marked by the impress of extremity. And I chose to narrow my concern of area of study to poets who'd lived through warfare as combatants or as non-combatants under military occupation, forced exile, imprisonment, and so on. In other words, the depredations of the state. And that was mistakenly read as a euphemism for political poetry and also a program for writing in a certain way. And what I really wanted was a freedom for us to open a space for the articulacy of these things, but also for the reading and appreciation of them. So it was a mode of reading, really, you know, that would allow in our literature a way to think and talk about these poems without the constraints of our own narrow political spectrum of dialogue and so on.
Yeah, it's very hard for any poet to inhabit that that kind of public space. And it's especially hard for North American poets in a number of ways, because as you're suggesting, you seem, decade after decade, generation after generation, we seem to have these two alternatives, neither of which is satisfactory, that the poet either berates herself for excluding that sort of thing for the work, or congratulates herself for getting it in there, and neither of those seem at all useful. And I think this is partly why when you open up Blue Hour and you see Carolyn Forché writing this poem in this mode, it's a very powerful act. It goes beyond, what you're doing in this poem, because you are the maker of that anthology, the person who made a lot of people think about those issues. And so the poem resonates into those issues, even though it is in, on the level of its subject matter, a step away from those issues. It's fascinating.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to clarify that, because it's been important to
me. Yeah, I know.
You know, it comes out of a defense of the evidentiary nature of Holocaust literature, you know, of preserving the importance of such literature in an age when we think of radical contingency as a mode of detaching the literary work from anything in the world, and, you know, arguing against its ability to represent. And what I'm sort of arguing is, okay, it's not commensurate with what happened, but it's evidence of what happened. It's language left on the ground, you know. Mm-hmm. It's as much evidence as anything else. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me, this particular time has been, as it is for all of us, we're in a different period, I think, in our culture as well, because of the vulnerability that people feel at the moment, our moment now.
That reminds me that, two places in the book, one in the notes and one at the end of On Earth, you very carefully mention when the poem was finished.
Yeah.
Which is it March 1999?
March 2001.
March 2001, of course.
And so it was done in the spring.
Yeah, and it's as if you feel the weight of what you're avoiding there. You want to say this poem was finished before September 11th. Yes?
It was, but one of the things, the reason I realized I had to put it there was that there was so many images here. Mm-hmm. Friends read it and said, oh, this is about September 11th. And I said, no, but it was frightening to realize how many images were,
available to them.
It's like the book sleeping off the shelf, you know, and giving me an epigraph or something. You know, these things happen, but they're a little frightening when they do. Mm-hmm. So, but I didn't want to claim that I was trying to make a poem that would be equal to that. You know, my problem isn't really that I can't really write a poem on a particular task. My problem was with occasional verse. If someone said, we want you to sit down and write a poem now about September 11th, or an anti-war poem, you know, it would be very dear to my heart to accomplish this, but it would take me years, maybe, you know, because it's taken me 10 years for each of my books, and by that time, no one's thinking about that event anymore, you know, so I would be late, you know, very late. Which is why I'm not in the Poets Against the War anthology, I am very much against the war, but I didn't have a poem, and I couldn't finish one in time.
Right.
So, you know, that's really the struggle for me.
No, I understand that.
And I never like anything. My wastebasket's very full.
I think that kind of hesitancy and caution speaks to not only to aesthetic power to political intelligence too, because the danger in those projects is the self-congratulation that goes along with it, the patting oneself on the back for having had these good thoughts, and it's difficult to separate out that narcissism from the deeply felt attachment to the right task. It leads me to want to think about something else that
it's true of activism as well. You know, you always have to monitor yourself. You know, what are my motivations? How am I orienting myself in this? In poetry now, one really important issue for me has been the distinction between speaking out of a self, being a subject on the page, and displaying personality. You know, just No, there is a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I really, it's very interesting to, you know, to continually examine, you know, what you're doing. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, and each of, you know, not just book by book, but poem by poem, you're doing that. The other thing that this makes me think of is the whole, you know, this isn't the first time this happens every now and again, but certainly in the last, you know, half decade or more, we've had lots of people really trying to make the big push to say poetry is popular and we like it. And it's a part of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had, you know, National Poetry Month, and we've had the, you know, the American Poem Project, and we've had, as our friend Richard Howard said, the worst thing that's happened to poetry since Homer. All have millions of dollars dumped on Poetry Magazine. how do we, where do you stand on that? What's the...
Well, my friend Lise, who's a poet here tonight, said it reminded me of Wallace Stevens' definition. Poetry is what helps us to live, you know. It's what's necessary to our lives. I believe in that necessity. But I don't believe that poetry can be reduced necessarily to some kind of consolation. You know, it's going to make us feel better, or it's going to be, you know,
mm-hmm.
It can't be just that, because there's so much at stake in the language and poetry as an expression of human consciousness and as the utterance of the soul, you know, and as the force that allows us to preserve what that is into the future for as long as we have, you know. It's so vitally important that I get nervous, you know, when people start defining it in smaller ways, you know, and giving it smaller tasks to perform, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think, you know, I think there's room for everything, but I don't think that you want to just relegate poetry over there to, you know, being a consolation prize for a terrible experience or, you know,
yes,
that's
exactly
how I feel.
Yeah,
and I'm very delighted that readings are well attended and that people are really interested. And they are. They seem to be. It seems to have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's due to a lot of people's efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important. But I want us to be careful to understand the powerful thing that it is. You know, I mean, I feel very daunted by it and always have.
Mm-hmm. There's also... Well, I've wondered anyway if there's the danger over these last few years that a poetry that is very beautiful because it is extremely difficult,
mm-hmm.
or extremely strange or deeply inward.
Are you talking about Blue Hole? Strange, yes. Okay.
There is no beauty without strangeness,
right,
as Bacon said. And I think that's true in some way, that the new, the, what is really new or alive is often very difficult and very strange and not available quickly. And this way of marketing poetry to the culture could be said to mitigate
to leave
against that
out.
Yes.
Yeah. That's, I think that's what I mean. I want that preserved because it's important.
Uh-huh.
It, you know, it extends our consciousness. It can actually do that.
Yes.
And that kind of pursuit of strangeness and difficulty and wonder and a lack and the unknowing is really the vital force of it.
Yes.
So that's very important to me. And
yes. Well, to go back to a word that you used at the very beginning of this conversation, it's difficult to write a poem that does not explain itself to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we want. We want to inhabit that unknowing, to work through the process, to inhabit the process of the poem.
That's right.
It's hard. It's hard work.
Yeah. You're done.
We're done.
Yeah.
I'm so sad. We'd only just started.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.